Well, another thing the president did not talk about today was Ukraine or Russia. But as Ari Shapiro reported this morning, worsening tensions with Russia have led to a stalling of the European economy in the last quarter. The crisis in Ukraine has led to economic sanctions against Russia and counter sanctions against the U.S. and Europe. And this morning, the EU reported that economic growth has flatlined. There is one area, though, where tensions between Russia and the West don't appear to have caused problems, and that is on the International Space Station. Right now, the U.S. relies on Russian spacecraft to get its astronauts to and from the station, and that has continued despite the diplomatic troubles. Joining us now to talk about that and much more is Charles Bolden, the administrator of NASA. Charles Bolden, welcome.
How are you doing, Jeremy? Good to be here.
Well, great to have you. And I want to start with the news, and that is, with all the tensions with Russia right now, are you at all concerned that the U.S. will not be able to get astronauts up to the space station?
I am not concerned because of the relationship that we managed to preserve with Roscosmos, which is our partner agency inside Russia. So it's the Russian Space Agency. You know, I will caveat that by saying that like us, they're a part of the government. So one never knows what can happen. But based on the day-to-day relationships and what's going on with our people, about 30 of them that work in and out of the Mission Control Center there in Moscow every single day, our astronauts who are training at the Gagarin Cosmonaut Training Center on the outskirts of Moscow, the indications we have are that they are as interested and enthusiastic as we about maintaining our partnership.
Well, how has that happened? Because even as the U.S. has been ratcheting up sanctions, you're saying it hasn't affected the cooperation between the space programs at all.
If you go back to a number of years ago when the Russians invaded Georgia, we had crews operating on the International Space Station. And at that time, both the American government and the Russian government were able to partition off the International Space Station. It's important for all of us to remember that the International Space Station doesn't belong to any single entity. It's a partnership among 20-some-odd nations. It's a mini United Nations. And I think all of the countries involved recognize the critical importance of that effort for the future of humanity, because the benefits from station come back to Earth to benefit all of us.
Well, a mini United Nations maybe, but the only ones with a ride up there are the Russians at this point. What would happen if the relationship worsened? Would the U.S. have any other way to get to the space station?
That is an issue that we think about, but we don't worry about it, because the Russians, Roscosmos, continues to be a reliable partner. They have come to our rescue several other times, most notably in 2003 when we lost the shuttle Columbia. And the only way that we had to get to space then was with the Russians. It's an issue that we continue to work, but one that I continue to remain hopeful and actually relatively confident we can continue to work with our Russian partners.
Well, and the other question is, when will we have a replacement for the shuttle? The reason that we have to rely on the Russians is because the shuttle was retired back in 2011. When will there be something else that can get humans, Americans, up into space?
Well, unfortunately, because of a lot of things that happen with budgets, we ended up with a little bit longer gap than we had originally planned between shuttle and the next capability. But right now, we're on track to have an American capability to get our astronauts and our partner astronauts to space to and from low Earth orbit by 2017. That's the target on which we're presently embarked, and it looks like we're in pretty good shape to do that.
A government vehicle or some kind of private company?
No. As a matter of fact, it's really important, Jeremy, that it not be a government vehicle. We want it to be a vehicle that is available from American industry and one from which the U.S. government purchases a service. So that's the whole concept. We demonstrated it, and it has turned out it is continuing to be a good investment for us in terms of getting cargo to and from space. Shortly after, about 2 years after we stopped flying the space shuttle, we finally brought online the commercial capability to get cargo to and from space. And we use two companies right now, SpaceX out of Hawthorne, California, and Orbital Sciences out of Dulles, Virginia. And that's the way we get cargo to and from space. We hope to do the same thing by 2017 for our crews. And it will be a fee for service, and the companies will provide the service of getting our astronauts back and forth.
And as we take that path, we do see headlines about new advances for the Indian Space Agency, or the Chinese, or the Europeans. Is our path the right path, do you think, to rely so heavily on the private sector?
Yes, I am certain that our path is the correct path. No other nation is able to do what we're able to do right now. No other nation has the capability to call on their industry to provide the kinds of services that we can do. If right now, all of our international partners rely on either heavily subsidized or government-run means to do things. And that's the way the U.S. used to do it, but we don't need to do that anymore. If you look at what our intelligence community is doing, if you look at what the U.S. military is doing, we are leading the way. NASA has demonstrated that U.S. industry is reliable, dependable, and in fact, in relative terms, cheap compared to what it cost us to maintain the infrastructure to do it all ourselves. The president, you know, came on board in 2009, and he said, you know, this is really the way we should be going. We're going to make this real. And so that's what we've done, and we now have a viable, dependable commercial capability to get cargo to space, and we're on the verge of having that same capability to get our human, our astronauts to space.
When do you think we're going to know whether there's life in outer space?
You know, in doing my homework, I looked over your interview with Tracy Caldwell Dyson and with Mike Gazarek and others. And
I always ask that question.
We're all of like mind. I think we're very close to finding out that there is life elsewhere in this solar system, not the least of which in the universe. What we mean when we talk about life is probably microbial form, you know, life in its most rudimentary form. But still, it's the building blocks for people like you and me. It's the way that at least people like me with a scientific bent believe that humanity started millions and millions of years ago. I'm confident that in my lifetime, we are probably going to find signs of life on other planets in this solar system, not to even mention that we probably will find evidence of some in other solar systems, maybe even in our own galaxy, the Milky Way.
We're speaking with NASA Administrator Charles Bolden. Don't go away. You're listening to Here and Now. It's Here and Now, and let's continue our conversation now with NASA Administrator Charles Bolden. And Charles Bolden, I want to talk to you about this line from President Obama back in 2010. Here is the president speaking at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida about NASA's future.
By the mid-2030s, I believe we can send humans to orbit Mars and return them safely to Earth. And a landing on Mars will follow. And I expect to be around to see it.
Charles Bolden, is that going to happen?
That's going to happen. And I say that with great confidence because it has been a very, very long road from the president saying that in April of 2010 to where we are today. When he made that statement, it was very similar to John Kennedy making the pronouncement before the Congress and then repeating it at Rice University Stadium back in the 60s, that before the end of this decade, we're going to put a human on the put a man, he said, on the moon and bring him safely back to Earth. If you go back and ask people, my predecessors in NASA, what they thought at that moment, I think almost to a person, they will tell you that they didn't know where the president came up with an idea like that, and they didn't think it could be done. Until the next day when they sat down and said, okay, it doesn't matter whether we can do it or not. We're gonna learn how to do it. And they did. Since the president said that in 2010, we have set out to make it possible. We are now building hardware for the Space Launch System, which is a heavy-lift launch vehicle, to carry a module called Orion that will carry our astronauts to deep space, to initially back to lunar orbit for an asteroid mission, where we will allow astronauts to interact with an asteroid that by then we hope to have redirected from its normal orbit of the sun into a cislunar orbit of the moon. And then from there, once we've developed the sufficient technologies, understand that we have reliable and robust, much more robust systems than we have today, we'll be off with humans to Mars. That is no, you know, I need to caution everyone. This is no easy feat. This president chose to challenge us to put humans in the Martian environment in the mid-2030s, and we accept that challenge, and we're well on the way to doing it. The big thing for us, huge thing, is going to be hopefully December 4th, you know, if all goes well, we will launch the Orion spacecraft on a test flight out of Cape Canaveral, Florida, on a Delta IV Heavy, and it will make two or three orbits of Earth, big elliptical orbits of Earth, farther than we've ever sent a spacecraft intended for human transportation in more than 40 years. It'll fly, safely return to Earth, touch down in the Pacific Ocean, and we'll retrieve it and then go over it with a fine-tooth comb to make sure that our design is appropriate and adequate, and keep working on till we're ready to put humans on it sometime at the end of this decade.
I want to ask you about another mission of NASA that may not be written in your mission statement, but it's something that we just spoke with Bill Nye about. He said if you want to increase the number of people in America who are going into science and math, give NASA a bigger budget. Do you think that NASA is inspiring the way that it did in the 60s, or what do you think could be done to have it perform that function and get more kids interested in science?
I have to measure what I say here. In many ways, I think we are much more inspiring today than we were in the 60s in the time of the Apollo era. You know, in the time of the Apollo era, a kid had to be sitting in front of a television to see Neil Armstrong land on the moon. NASA had no education and outreach program. Today, NASA is spending $17 billion on education. And I don't say that in jest. Every dime that we spend on our programs has some impact on reaching students, not only here in America, but around the world. So while our education budget proper may be relatively small, we get benefits from every dime that we spend on the programs that we do, because almost every single project or program has an educational outreach component or a STEM education component that allows us to touch kids all over this country and all around the world.
Well, and you know, as we said, you are a former astronaut. What inspired you?
Believe it or not, a person inspired me. Now, I like gazillions of other people, sat mesmerized watching Neil Armstrong step out and set foot on the moon in 1969. That did not inspire me to want to be an astronaut. At the time, I thought being an astronaut was impossible for me, so I never even considered it. I was mesmerized, but not something I wanted to do. I was inspired by a young man by the name of the late, great Dr. Ron McNair. Ron and I grew up about 42 miles from each other in South Carolina. I grew up in Columbia. He grew up in Lake City, and we did not know each other. He was a little bit younger than me, but had always dreamed of being an astronaut, joined the Astronaut Corps in 1978 when he was selected as a PhD out of MIT, foremost laser physicist, one of the foremost laser physicists in this nation, fifth-degree black belt in karate, accomplished jazz musician. And he came to visit where I was working as a test pilot, and we talked for a weekend. And when he got ready to leave, he said, "Hey, are you going to apply for the program?" I said, "Not on your life, Ron." And he looked at me, he said, "Why not?" I said, "They'd never pick me." And he looked at me and he chuckled. He said, "You know, that's the dumbest thing I ever heard." He said, "How do you know if you don't apply?" And what happened was I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed, because my mother and father, just like Ron's mom and dad, had told him, "You can do anything you want to do as long as you're willing to put your mind to it and work hard." And I had forgotten what my mom and dad had taught me, and Ron had to remind me so brutally. And after that, I picked up my pen and paper, and I applied for the space program. And I was fortunate enough to be nominated by the Marine Corps and interviewed down in Houston, Texas, and got selected by NASA. So I was inspired by Ron McNair.
Well, and it must have been quite something for you personally, as somebody who grew up in the segregated South.
Yeah, you just hit the nail on the head. One of the reasons I didn't think it was possible was because that was my mindset. I was not unlike many young African-American kids, young kids of color growing up in the segregated South. We were conditioned to believe that there were limits to what we could do. My mom and dad were teachers, and so they tried to make sure that I never put an artificial limitation on myself, and in spite of all their efforts, I did. And it took Ron to shake me and wake me. That's what NASA tries to do for students today. And that's the reason I say I think in many ways we are much more inspiring than we were in the Apollo era. Do you know how many black kids had any hope of becoming an astronaut in the Apollo era? Zero. You know how many girls had any hope of becoming an astronaut in the Apollo era? Zero. Why? Because there was no one like them. And they knew that you had to be a test pilot, and they assumed you had to be white. That is no longer the case. That paradigm was shattered by the space shuttle program, an incredible 30-year program. And everybody talks about its technological accomplishments. Let me tell you, as a human being, I think its greatest achievement was opening the doors to space exploration for everybody on this planet, young boys, young girls. I just celebrated the christening of the research vessel Sally Ride. The Navy built it for ocean-going research. That is a living example of what can be done, and we would not have been able to do that had it not been for NASA and the space shuttle.
Charlie Bolden, the administrator of NASA, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you very much. It's my pleasure, and come visit us sometime. We'd love to do this face-to-face.
We would love to as well. Well, what would you like NASA to do next? What would inspire you? Let us know at our website, hereandnow.org, or at facebook.com/hereandnowradio.